Hello, I'm Simon Burton and welcome to a well-stocked edition of Arts Roundup, reporting on the city's arts and cultural dimension, which certainly promises to keep us entertained and busy for the rest of the summer. In this edition, we meet Dr. David Crilly, the exceptional man behind Cambridge's Shakespeare Festival, and talk to the actors about the hectic world behind the scenes. We take a tour of the newly renovated Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology with exhibition coordinator Dr. Mark Elliott and outreach officer Sarah Jane Hartnett. Kath Kemp previews the forthcoming film festival. Artist Peter Newsome introduces his extraordinary glass sculptures at Clare College. And photographer and lecturer Mark Woods-Nunn talks about his work and a new portrait exhibition at Cambridge Arts Salon.
It was a lover and his lass, with a hey and a ho and a hey honey now, that over the green cornfields it passed, in the springtime, the only springtime,
when birds do sing,
hey ding a ding,
sweet lovers love the spring,
between the acres of the rye, these pretty country folk to lie.
It's been written up in the Sunday Times as the most significant cultural event in the region and has attracted season ticket buyers who are jetting in from overseas. So it's no wonder the Cambridge Shakespeare Festival has attracted passionate local audiences to the college gardens despite the wet weather. We're halfway through the 8-play season and currently running is King Lear at King's College, A Midsummer Night's Dream at Trinity, Twelfth Night at Robinson College and As You Like It at Girton College. Artistic director Dr. David Crilly took time out at the set of As You Like It at Girton College to talk about the Herculean task he has of directing the series each summer. I asked if by playing with these dramatic sparks, real love was ever ignited behind the scenes, like the film Shakespeare in Love.
There is more drama behind the scenes than there ever is on stage, I can assure you. Our record at the moment is, we have a statistic, which is, I think at the moment, 7-8-1. Which is in the last 10 years, we have 7 marriages, 8 children, and 1 divorce. So there's a lot of romance that goes on behind the scenes in the Shakespeare Festival.
In reality, it takes a huge amount of hard work to create a successful Shakespeare production. And you're not just doing 1 or 2, you're doing 8 in one summer. Now, how on earth do you do that?
I don't really know, because when I say it out loud, it sounds madness to me. But it's how it's grown over the last 25 years. When I'm thinking of the programme, I'm thinking of a variety of different things, of doing things that I know will be popular, but also doing more challenging things that I haven't done before. So just the idea of doing 1 or 2 wouldn't really fit the bill. And it's just grown. It's morphed into something huge.
You must have a really amazing knowledge of Shakespeare's works by now.
It's a passion of mine, certainly, and I love it. And it's a wonderful thing to be immersed in for so long. And I think what tends to happen by the end of the summer, I'm speaking in blank verse half the time because it's just there inside.
Yeah, I was going to say that the passions that Shakespeare's plays arouse in people never dulls through the ages. It translates into each age. That goes on. Why do you think that is? Why do you think Shakespeare is always universally true?
Because of his understanding of the human psyche. We know all the people in Shakespeare's plays. We all know, if we think of something like the kind of plays that we've been doing this year, The Merry Wives of Windsor, we know the characters in there. We know the kind of personal intrigues of those people. We can identify with them. With A Midsummer Night's Dream, with the amateur dramatics of the mechanicals. We know those people.
For the actors, these roles can be very difficult parts to master, sure. Can't they? So what are the issues thrown up by taking Shakespeare from the traditional stage and throwing it into a garden? I mean, it is, in a way, a natural fantasy backdrop to have a well-ordered garden behind a piece of action like that anyway, isn't it?
It's great for something like An Midsummer Night's Dream because we can use the gardens of Trinity College. It makes a fantastic kind of woodland landscape. On the other hand, though, doing something like King Lear in King's College Garden, as we are at the moment, it's a beautifully manicured garden, and it doesn't lend itself to that kind of action. So it's a really, it's a much greater challenge for the actors, because we have the actors, we have their costumes, and we have their ability to convey the power and intensity of that drama without all the kind of padding that you would normally find in a traditional theatre with lights and trapdoors and smoke and mirrors and all that kind of thing.
Has the disruption caused by the bad weather actually been a big problem? Because you must plan for all of those contingencies anyway, don't you?
Well, our plan for bad weather is to carry on.
That's
what we do, and it certainly the start of the festival. It was more of a problem for the rehearsal period actually, because we rehearse outdoors as well. Because in order to prepare for the outdoor experience, we do everything outdoors. So we were rehearsing from 9 a.m. till 8:30 in the evening in the rain, and we just had to get on with that.
Does nature ever oblige with a clap of thunder at a timely point during a play like the Tent Festival?
Occasionally, we've had that in the past. It's been great. We had a great production of Macbeth a few years ago where exactly that happened. We had lots of thunder and lightning towards the end, and it couldn't have been better.
So how many of you are there, and how many roles do each of them take on in one summer?
There are about 45 actors in the company at the moment and 5 associate directors. Again, it depends on the role. So, for example, an actor called David Shackleton, who's currently playing King Lear. Well, he's only playing King Lear in that production. But one of the actresses who's playing Cordelia, she's also playing the Fool. So there's a range. Normally, the main profile parts will only be, they'll only have one role. But then with the supporting roles, they might have one or two supporting roles. The buzz I get out of doing the festival is that tonight, for example, I can be at Girton College and sit back and watch this beautiful romantic idyll unfold, and then I can pop down the road to King's College and watch everyone being gripped by the blinding of Gloucester and all the horrible things going on there, and then I can go down to Trinity and see the magic of A Midsummer Night's Dream. And so it's that kind of, it's a balance of types of things. So we have the magical, the tragic, and the comic farce of Merry Wives and things like that. So there's a real balanced programme. That's my aim.
Okay, now this evening you're putting on As You Like It in Girton College Gardens. Can you tell me a little bit about the synopsis?
The basic premise is that there is a deposed duke who lives in the Forest of Arden with his followers. He has a daughter and a niece who live with the usurping duke, and they are banished from the court, and they go to Arden. So they go to a different world to live, to look for their father and uncle. Before they leave, one of the characters meets Orlando, who she immediately falls in love with, and then encounters him in the Forest of Arden as well. So it's quite a complicated story, but it's an idyll of mistaken identity, of disguise comedy, and of all the intrigues that come through pretending to be somebody else. And it's about the experience of a whole different way of being. As the situation unfolds in As You Like It, we're exposed to the absurdity of the court, for example, and how that when taken out of the court, all the affectations of society suddenly become ridiculous. And that, of course, relates to our own experience, that is, when we're in a different environment, that all the things that we regard as normal and essential are quite shallow and superficial. So it's that kind of journey for the actors and for the audience to see how to reassess ourselves in our culture and our situation, and to see how we respond to other cultures and other situations. It's a real thing for me that I don't think Shakespeare is taught particularly well in school, and it's great that parents are happy to bring their children along, and it's remarkable the response we get from the children, who haven't actually been told that it's hard, or it's clever, or it's difficult yet. So they'd come along and find that it actually isn't.
It's no simple task to learn one demanding Shakespeare role and carry it off successfully. But I met members of the cast of As You Like It who've been taking on several parts, including a lead, and performing in more than one Shakespeare play inside just a few weeks. Actor Samuel Griffith is now playing the character of Touchstone, and actress Fleur Shepherd plays both Audrey and Le Beau in As You Like It, having already won popular praise as Kate in Taming of the Shrew. Playing the part of Kate in Taming of the Shrew, is there a part of your character at all that's like Kate? I mean, it must be quite a difficult role to take on, one of Shakespeare's greatest.
Yes, it's been a dream part for me, actually. I was so excited about it, and I'm still excited about it, even though it's over. Not naturally, I actually had... I sort of did quite a lot of research into it. My sister, very sweetly, growing up, because obviously the relationship between Kate and Bianca is very interesting, and my sister and I didn't have anywhere near as horrible a relationship, but my lovely sister was very supportive in talking through about family dynamics and stuff, so that really helped.
When you put on the actress's mask and you become Kate and go through that process of acting out her character, do you take something away from that in yourself at the end of it? Do you think, do you see things in yourself that you didn't realise were there, discover faculties and live sort of more vigorously as a result of escaping into Shakespeare's world and being this passionate, fiery person?
Definitely. It's so much fun being an actor because you get to play out things that you'd never usually be able to do in real life. You have an excuse to behave in a way that you would never do. And so it's a lovely opportunity. You get a closer insight into different people and personalities and ways of working and being, and therefore, yeah, I think it's quite normal to take a little bit with you.
And how difficult is it to play two roles and two Shakespeares in one summer? Because that's quite a big demand, isn't it, on your, you know, on your time and your psyche and everything else. I mean, do you find that really a big challenge to do so quickly from one to another?
It is definitely a challenge, mm-hmm. but that's one of the appeals for me about doing the festival, is that it's a challenge for the actor to be able to have to be doing one character at night and then rehearsing another character in the daytime. You are definitely having to push yourself, but it's a challenge that I think everyone rises to really well.
I was going to say, I think with the decline of repertory theatre in England these days, it's something that a lot of younger actors of mine and Fleur's age have missed out on, being able to play all these different parts and having to learn one part whilst performing in a play. And it's a very valuable experience as an actor, I think.
Can you tell me about your role in As You Like It this evening?
Sure. My character is Touchstone. He's the fool for the court. He's a companion to the two main female characters, Rosalind and Celia. He's very witty, he's very debonair and intelligent, but he uses his foolishness as a cover for his wit, to kind of a man out of sorts wherever he is. He's too foolish to fit in the court, but then he's too courtly to fit in the forest, you know, so.
When you're given a role like that, presumably, I mean, you study it carefully so you understand what you're supposed to do, but then you have to take it away with you, don't you? Personalise it for your particular handwriting, as it were.
Yes.
How long does that take?
Well, it's something that if you're lucky, it happens organically in rehearsals. It will come through, but sometimes you make bold choices. You say, I want to give him a limp and an eye patch and, you know, a Cornish accent. It's not a pirate, but... but sometimes you do have to make very bold choices, and those are something you impose on the text. But, I mean, a lot of the time, I think it's best if you allow things to happen organically, or if your director suggests, why not try this, or why not try that? And hopefully it all comes together. And you might try something, and it falls flat on its face. And you go, I'll never try that again. But then you might try something and it might be really successful and people might really enjoy it.
So. And it also depends on the dynamic between, because we play opposite each other in this, in As You Like It, and I think it also depends on who you're working with. The person might bring out something in you that you didn't, in your character that you didn't necessarily anticipate. So you might come with a whole load of ideas and they might all be chucked out the first minute that you start working with the company. So
you have to create chemistry between the actors as well.
Absolutely, the whole company, you know, it's all about that kind of dynamic, which is why it's so lovely that each production is always so different, because even if the director's done it so many times, the actors will bring something different to it.
Obviously, Shakespeare, the most amazing poet that ever lived, but when you've gone through, you know, playing those roles, what does that do in terms of contributing to your talent and future as an actor, do you think? Do you think it's really sharpened you up and taken you in ways that you haven't done before? Or?
Well, I mean, especially with this festival, I do think, you know, you are learning a specific skill to do outdoor Shakespeare. It's not like doing it in an intimate black box studio space or something like that. So definitely, and the way that the festival works, it's very, very playful. And, you know, you're playing to audiences who hopefully on a nice sunny day will bring a picnic. And so it involves lots of audience interaction. And, you know, that in itself is a skill. So.
Being in a kind of informal setting, does that actually enable you to relax and open up a bit as an actor in a way that you wouldn't on stage?
Really? I think particularly with As You Like It, because it's a play that's so much about the outdoors and nature, and performing it in a lovely space here at Girton College, it's a really beautiful place.
And how have you found the Cambridge audiences?
Enthusiastic. What is so lovely actually is when we go out leafleting and promoting the shows, it's sort of almost quite unnerving, because you get people coming up to you, oh, we saw you in Taming of the Shrew, or we saw this, and do tell the cast of Midsummer Night's Dream how much we loved it. And they, you know, you have people, if you were leafleting in London or maybe Edinburgh, people would be sort of ignoring you, but you go leafleting here, people are actively turning around to come back to you. They love it and they're so supportive, it's wonderful.
And have there been any particular highlights in your adventure through Cambridge's colleges that you remember from this year, that particularly marked this year for you?
I'd say the first night Taming of the Shrew was pretty special,
amazing.
Wasn't it?
Absolutely amazing. And the adrenaline was sort of through the roof, because for both of us it's our first year here, so it's a new setup, but it was just amazing, and Downing was beautiful. And
give me your favourite line from this play this evening.
He's trying to woo this woman, and he's saying all sorts of different things to try and convince her to see him in a different light. And he says, "Oh, I would thou hadst been made poetical, for if thou wert a poet, I might have some hope thou didst fame." You know?
It wasn't quite so ignorant. No. My favourite simile is from that scene, and she says, well, Touchstone says, "Oh, well, sluttishness might come later," and she says, "Oh, I'm not a slut, but I thank the gods I am foul." So it's brilliant.
Wonderful. Yeah. That's great. Thank you very much.
As You Like It runs at Girton College Gardens until August the 25th. You found us. This is Cambridge 105. Cambridge's Summer in the Museum season kicked off a couple of months ago with the reopening of the newly revamped Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology, which has been much awaited after being closed for nearly 3 years. The £1.9 million renovation is quite an eye-opener, with visually exquisite new displays and a set of artefacts that any museum would find it hard to beat. Most contributed by explorers, travellers, missionaries and administrators from across the world during the age of exploration in the 19th century, and some pieces date back over 2 million years. Through a new entrance in Downing Street, you'll discover an impressive new gallery of Cambridge archaeology and temporary exhibitions on the ground floor, and an emerging gallery of world archaeology on the top floor. I spent a riveting 15 minutes with Museum Coordinator Mark Elliott and Outreach Officer Sarah Jane Hartnett, exploring the myriad of exhibits which really shouldn't be missed.
What we've been trying to do with the ground floor galleries, basically the new galleries on the ground floor, there's a permanent gallery of local archaeology of Cambridge and Cambridgeshire and the wider region, and there's a temporary exhibition gallery that will have new exhibits rotating throughout the year. What we've tried to do with the Cambridge gallery is to introduce the, as you say, some of the mass of the material that we have, and really present as much of our collections as we can in as visually engaging a way as possible. Because some of the stuff that we have here is, you know, truly visually amazing.
Now this all ties in with the summer in the museum season, whereby all of the museums are basically open to the public so that they can come and see things. And I've just been into the Sedgwick Museum and saw the amazing things that are there, which children were absolutely ogling at, the dinosaurs, the fossils, the quartz crystals and things like that. Basically, there's been something of a revolution in the way that the university opens its doors to the public.
Well, I'm the outreach organiser we've been doing summer trails and summer joint activities across all the museums for several years, and it's all about getting local people in during the summer. All the university museums are free, so people can pop in for 10 minutes while they're in town if they want to.
So we have collections that were brought here by that came here from the first voyages of Captain Cook in the South Pacific. We have collections that were excavated by archaeologists working all over the world, from the John Lewis site about 160 metres down the road to Africa, Australia, all over. This is really what we're trying to get at, the diversity of people, the ingenuity and creativity of people all over the world.
A lot of these artefacts are simply, they're wonders, aren't they? Wonderful masks, you have pottery, you have costumes, you have artefacts, and also you have films and audio tracks as well. Can you tell me about some of the key exhibits here in the museum?
Well, certainly. The collections at this museum, we have something in the region of 1 million objects, of which we can only ever display less than 1%. So these objects, and these about 800,000 objects from archaeology and anthropology collections, it also includes about 200,000 photographs, as well as film and other archives and documentation that tell the story about how these artifacts were collected, who made them, why they made them, why they were collected, and how they got here. So we have this extraordinary range that actually, in we see here in this introductory display, we see some of our artifacts from across the collections displayed alongside the photographs, which tell the stories of the really often quite intimate and personal connections that were made between British and European collectors, some of them from right here in Cambridge, some of them from elsewhere, with people in the Arctic, in Papua New Guinea, in Vanuatu, and throughout the world. This is one of my favourite photographs, actually. This shows a curator of the museum called Thomas Patterson in the 1930s learning how to make a string figure, and he's been taught by this amazing looking Inuit woman there in Greenland, and she's clearly in the photograph telling him, well, she looks a little bit impatient because he's not really picking it up quickly enough.
And there's some fantastic masks here that are, some of them are quite spooky, aren't they? These are sort of things that kids would have a wonderful time with, wouldn't they?
I think there are some incredible visually striking artifacts. This piece is actually, this is a mask from the Torres Strait, which is, the Torres Strait Islands are a group of islands between Australia and Papua New Guinea, and this artifact was collected by a man called Alfred Haddon, who was one of the first lecturers in anthropology here in Cambridge, and he travelled to the Torres Strait in 1888, and he collected this piece, which is, it's presented here in a glass case, but of course it would have, I mean, all these masks would have moved around, they would have been danced, they would have been really, really quite active things, and they would have been intended to astonish the viewer, and what we've tried to do is make them, is, you know, return them to being, you know, as astonishing as we think they are. This is amazing. It shows a transformation of a man into a crocodile. So you see at the top there's this human face. It's all made from turtle shell. It has shells and nuts hanging off it to make a noise as it dances. It's got extraordinary plumes of cassowary feathers all over the place. And it would have caught the light. It would have really astonished people as it moved around. We have a small collection on display from Easter Island. We have, as well as artifacts, as well as photographs, of course, particularly from the 1920s and 1930s, people start making audio recording and film. In fact, some of the film that we have on display here is some of the earliest anthropological film from anywhere, and it was made in the Torres Strait, again, in 1898, and it shows people from the Torres Strait dancing a masquerade. So film, moving images, sound are just as important as the artifacts in this collection. In this corner of the gallery, this is part of our new temporary exhibition, which is Gifts and Discoveries, and it's telling the story about, that answers one of the main questions that people ask when they come to the museum. This is amazing stuff, but what on earth is it doing here? How did it get here? And these two displays are video and sound installations that revolve around some of our artifacts. Over here we have exhibit that's made by an artist in residence, Alana Jelinek, and she is working on a collection of artifacts from Fiji, which is part of a big research project that's going on here at the museum at the moment, and working on the different ways in which these artifacts carry different kinds of stories with them. The way that people make things, the material properties of things, but also just the stories that people tell as they're making things. So that's a big collaborative project that we actually, it includes a lot of artifacts that people in the museum, myself, Sarah Jane, lots of other people, have been making as part of this. So some of them are good, some of them are bad. It's very important for us to make the collections accessible in lots of different ways. We are so lucky. Every day we come into work and we get to interact with this incredible stuff. And as I say, we exhibit about less than 1%, about 0.6% of our collection. Someday, hopefully, we'll have more space to show more. But it's fine to see something in a glass case. That's great. That can offer an amazing way of engaging with it. But we also have special events throughout the year. Touch tables, for example, where we bring out some of the collections, some of the ancient stone tools, the stone tools that are, you know, 1.8 million years old. And when you hold them in your hand, it's incredible. They fit. They're made to be held in the hand. Different ways of learning about how archaeologists identify artifacts and reassembling pots and that sort of thing. And also, particularly with different exhibitions, we have workshops on weaving and basketry and putting stuff together. In fact, Sarah Jane can probably tell you about something like that.
Yeah. We've got a workshop on the 18th of August. It's a felt making workshop. It's taking place here in the museum. It's all day. I think it's £16. The booking details are on our website.
Great. Okay, now we've moved moved upstairs into a beautifully white and pristine art gallery. What's going on here?
Well, this gallery is a temporary gallery that we use during the university vacations, and this particular exhibition is called Unlimited Global Alchemy, and it's our museum's contribution to the Cultural Olympiad, and it's part of the Unlimited project. And it's an exhibition by an artist called Rachel Gadsden, and it's working with, and she collaborated with a group called the Bambanani Group in Cape Town, South Africa. The Bambanani Group, led by the artist and activist Nondumiso Hurwelwe, were formed in the first place as a group to combat prejudice and get support for sufferers of HIV. They campaigned successfully to obtain antiretroviral medicine from the South African government. Since then, they're working a lot with issues of body image. We have a collection that have been on display here for quite a while. You'll have seen one down in the reception area of body maps, which were made by members of this group.
We're in the Maudsley Hall now, which is a beautiful room with a coral balcony and a terribly high ceiling. And there are a couple of really interesting things in here. First of all, obviously, is this amazing totem pole made from wood. I've never seen anything like it.
And this totem pole came to the museum in the 1920s. And actually, it hasn't moved since, obviously, because it's enormous. It's quite hard to move. You can see actually halfway up, a lot of people ask us how we got it in here. And the way you look at this place, it almost seems like the museum was built around it. Actually, it came about 10 years afterwards. And it was built, the museum, I guess, was built around the idea of a totem pole. They really wanted one, and they fought quite hard to get one. But you can see halfway up, you can see the whale in the middle of the killer whale in the middle of the totem pole. You can see its blowhole and its fin. Just under its eyes, you can see a line where it's been cut, and it was cut for transport. So it was brought in then, and it's been standing here ever since. This used to be the Gallery of the Americas. It's been the Anthropology Gallery for a couple of decades now, and it's an extraordinary space. It's in a sense, it's a museum of a museum. You have these beautiful old Edwardian displays. It's incredible richness of stuff from all over the world. The objects are sort of, you know,
it's an absolute treasure trove in here of interesting things. You've got Buddha statues from the Far East. You've got samurai costumes from Japan.
This is another enormous sculpture, and this is also from the Northwest Coast, the same part of the world as the totem pole comes from. And this is a great big bear house post. It would have been part of the architecture of a town. You can see beside the totem pole here, there's a photograph of a Haida village, which actually includes the totem pole in it. So you get a sense of the village and the landscape and the architecture that these things would have been a part of. Down here we've got a kayak from the Arctic, and it was collected, this is actually collected in the 1930s. Beside it, though, there are models of Polynesian and Melanesian canoes. We've got this extraordinary model of, it's probably about a quarter of the size that it would have been, of a canoe from the Solomon Islands, which has this amazing shell encrusted and inlaid prow rising up from it. And actually, if you follow the line of this all the way up to the top, you see this
suspended from the ceiling. Yeah, absolutely wonderful.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And this is actually from the northern coast of West Papua, which is part of the island of New Guinea, and it's from it's the Indonesian side of West Papua, and it came into the museum in 1911. And unlike the totem pole, it hasn't been cut, and we think that probably came in through one of the windows as they were building it, and it hasn't moved. And let's be honest, probably won't be moving in a hurry.
Well, this looks like the most incredible renovation, such an interesting place to come and see during the summer in the museum series. Can you tell me a little about when you're open to the public?
Well, the museum is open free of charge, like all Cambridge University museums, and it's open from Tuesdays to Saturdays from 10:30 to 4:30.
Thank you very much indeed.
Great, thank you. Okay, that's
when the month draws to its end, you're being invited to celebrate film as the Cambridge Film Festival takes off in a variety of genres and stimulating settings across the city. It's a rare chance to catch up on new mainstream work, rub shoulders with visiting industry insiders, hear from directors, and you can explore foreign films and work you didn't know about from the fringes. The work of Alfred Hitchcock will be one focus, as well as films for children, and you won't have to be conventional about where you watch your cinema, as the film festival's Kath Kemp explains.
Some of you may be familiar now with our Grantchester Meadows screenings. They happen every year now on the August Bank Holiday weekend, and they're two nights of outdoor cinema down next to the orchard in Grantchester Meadows, right by the river, so you can see this huge air screen that we have, absolutely ginormous air screen that gets inflated by 8 o'clock, and we have beautiful films, and this year we're actually going to not just screen one film but screen two films each night, so that's the Saturday and the Sunday. We're going to screen a children's feature at the same time as the main feature films. So on the Saturday night we have The Woman in Black, so it's kind of something spooky for anybody that wants to punt out or bring a rug and get a bit spooked out. And then on the Sunday night, we have The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, which is the big Judi Dench film that was out this year.
And what's that about? What's the plot?
So that's got like an all-star British cast, and it's set in India.
Last year we had quite a few entries as the African part of the film festival. Is there anything coming this year from Africa within the lineup that's coming up?
To be honest, I'm not actually sure yet. I know that we were talking about doing a little African season. I'm not sure if that's going to be confirmed yet, but we will have the main Cambridge African Film Festival, which will happen in November. So it may not be part of the September festival, but we'll certainly have African films back in November.
So what else is in the lineup? Obviously, you've got stuff for children, you'll have a selection of films, but will there be mainstream films and a lot of fringe films involved as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think one of our opening night films is Snows of Kilimanjaro. We've also got Hope Springs, which has got Meryl Streep in. But we've got a whole range of submissions, so new films that not been seen in a cinema before. We'll have had some highlights from Edinburgh and Cannes, so lots of independent, and then quite a lot of local filmmakers as well.
Who's organising the film festival? Because in its origins, it was very much improved by people like Francois Ballet at the Arts Cinema, that's now the Arts Picture House. It used to invite quite a few celebrities to Cambridge. There are people like Barry Norman, who's the famous film critic. Quite a lot of British film directors used to come to it again now. What's happening this year in terms of how the organisation has moved on and who will be coming in to attend the film festival? Because it hasn't lost its glamour, has it, at all?
No, well, certainly last year was probably sort of our biggest year, having the premiere of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, and we had Gary Oldman, and we had the director. This year, special guests be confirmed. I think we've got the directors for the two opening night films here. We'll going to have a big Hitchcock revival season, which is going to be very big, so a bit more glamour there. But yeah, really other special guests, just check back the website to see who we're going to have. Peter Bradshaw usually comes.
Who's actually directing the whole festival? Who's in the kingpin position?
So that's Tony Jones. He's the festival director and has been this is the 32nd Cambridge Film Festival now, and it was his idea. So he's still very much in charge and runs all of the outdoor cinema and is a projectionist and sources all the films, so he works very hard.
have any of the films actually been shot locally? Obviously, there are lots of people who start their film careers on the streets of Cambridge making their own films. There are amateur groups who make things like horror films, Bloody Cuts and things like that. There are Cambridge University groups who make films, people who start their acting careers from doing that. Is any of that material that's locally made being featured in the film festival at all?
We should have, like I said, we have a big submissions process, and we have a lot of local filmmakers, that's filmmakers from the eastern counties, that submit their film, and certainly I, as a reviewer, have watched quite a few of those this year, and you know quite a few of them have been shot around Mill Road, so you see local scenes of Cambridge. I'm not responsible for the final decision, so whether anyone will make it onto the big screen, I'm not sure. We will have a rural cinema conference actually, that's going to take place in during the film festival, which will bring together people working in the industry and then anybody sort of interested in rural touring cinema, which is a big thing at the moment. And we work closely with the Cambridge Film Consortium, which puts on a lot of the events that you just mentioned, and a couple of those again will feature this year.
Now the way we watch cinema is actually changing quite a bit now, isn't it? Because obviously lots of people watch DVDs, or they watch things, you know, on their computers and what have you. But there's also been developments such as a rooftop cinema has opened at the Varsity Hotel, where instead of being crammed into a traditional cinema, you can just get a cocktail from the bar and stand on the rooftop and watch a screen in the open air on a summer evening. And we're seeing obviously the big screenings on Grantchester Meadows. You know, people are sort of finding different ways to do their cinema now, aren't they?
Absolutely. And I think last year particularly we found we had really good turnout for Grantchester Meadows. I mean, obviously, the weather's always an issue, so whether people are going to turn up on the day, you're never quite sure. But Varsity is absolutely stunning to be that far above the city. You have a beautiful skyline, you have a film in front of you, and like you say, it's just a completely different experience.
And looking at the Arts Picture House, which is obviously a major art cinematic hub in the city, there's been that kind of merger between where you go and eat, where you go and see photography or art exhibitions and films, all in the same building. Is that very much the central focal point of the film festival?
I think so. I mean, we really like to use venues all around the city, and this year we'll be using a couple of new venues like the Cambridge Buddhist Centre up on New Market Road. Fair to say that our main activity is usually at the Arts Pitch House, because as you say, it's such a hub of activity for local people interested in film.
What else is there on offer for people in terms of genres or things that will you be showing things like the remake of Total Recall, for example, which is coming out with Colin Farrow or what have you, any day now?
Well, we certainly will have mentioned the Hitchcock revival, which has got lots of new prints in it. We'll have contemporary German cinema, that's usually very popular. We've had that for the past few years, and lots of short programs, they're always very popular. And like you say, the Cambridge Family Film Festival, which usually happens in the mornings at the weekend of the festival. So yeah, we try and reach out to everybody that may have any interest in film whatsoever.
Also, where can people find out all about the festival and all its various tentacles, basically?
Oh yeah, so we've just, as of last week, launched our sort of brand new website, which is www.cambridgefilmfestival.org.uk, and that really is the main portal this year for it's really interactive. People can join our Twitter, can join our newsletter feed, and as the programme gets confirmed and as updates come up, the website's really the first place to look.
Okay. Catherine Kemp, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
A new sound for a new generation. This is Cambridge 105.
If you've never seen a glass violin before, or sculptures that perhaps have the appearance of a visitation from another dimension in a garden setting, or would be intrigued by a sundial made from glass, then you're certainly missing something a bit different. Glass sculptor Peter Newsom is exhibiting 17 of his remarkable works at Clare College in Herschel Road, and it's well worth a visit. He gave me a short talk on the works that have won him a series of prestigious large-scale commissions. Peter, here we are at Clare Hall, a wonderful gallery space going round like it's a small cloister with a pond in the middle, and your beautiful glass sculptures posited all the way around for people to have a look at. What initially attracted you to working with glass as a medium? Because it's quite unusual, really.
Yes, it's a very challenging medium, but at the same time, it's a very rewarding one. It's a unique material. Architects, I think, have really sort of cottoned on to the value of glass. Look at any building these days, and there are acres of glass. As a sculptor, one wants to do things which are sort of less rectangular, but nevertheless potentially just as rewarding, or if not more so. I'm very much a hands-on sculptor. I produce almost everything under my own hand. Occasionally I have to perhaps send a piece for toughening or buy in a steel component, something of that sort. But otherwise I cut, grind, polish and assemble the glass to create the sculpture.
A lot of these sculptures are multi-layered with beautiful curved shapes and points and obscure angles and things like that. To actually end up with one finished sculptor, how much glass do you smash normally in a session, as it were?
not a great deal, because I've been doing it for a little while now. But at the same time, the finished components have to be perfect, or otherwise it's the bin. Glass is a very unforgiving material in that sense, in that you cut it, if it's not cut in the right way, in the right place, then you start again, which, you know, unlike something like clay where you can just make an adjustment.
And most of your work I see has similar colouring to it. I mean, you've got blue, and then you have this slightly smoked transparent and glass. Do you always stick to those colours?
Not always. There's a commission that I did a couple of years back for a cruise ship, where it was a requirement for multicoloured glass for the solarium of the oasis of the seas. And there I used probably about 15 different multicoloured glasses, which the sort of glass that's used for stained glass windows in churches and so on. I have a preference really for clear glass, for the reason that I'm interested in light and form. And if one has almost clear glass, that allows that interplay to come to the front. I like the sort of look of fragility of the glass, perhaps, but I know, I sometimes say to people, if they worry about the fragility, when did you last break a window? It's not too often. So they're really very robust.
Now, one of your pieces was a beautiful violin made of glass. Can you tell me what led to that sculpture?
Yes. I'm not a musician. I've absolutely no talent in that respect. But I happened to be watching one of the Promenade concerts on the Beeb, and I was struck by both the beauty of form of the string session, and also the dynamic enthusiasm of the violinists. And with that sculpture, I try to capture something of both the form, but also by introducing a twist into the actual sculpture to suggest something of the dynamism of the musicians.
Now, do you play quite a lot with the interaction of light going through your sculptures? Because that's quite an important element of it, isn't it?
Oh, it is. Yeah. It's absolutely crucial. A hero of mine, Constantine Brancusi, said that one of the goals of a sculptor is that combination of light and form, and I think that's really quite central to what I do, because I, in that way, I'm able to create a sculpture which is dynamic in the sense that light changes, the direction of view of the viewer changes. But I must say, the violin is a piece which there's an enormous number of pieces in it, and every piece, with the exception of perhaps just one or two at the top there, it has a different shape. And so
there must be 200 pieces of glass involved.
It's something approaching that, certainly. So yes, it took me, well, in that case actually a couple of months of continuous work to create the piece, and it involves a combination of clear glass but also rather attractive cobalt glass, and one of the rare occasions that I've actually used torch manipulation of hot glass in order to create some of the...
It's great looking at this glass violin, all the way the light goes through it, because the light is captured in it, isn't it? And that kind of gives it a life of its own, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Yes.
It's like a prism, isn't it?
Yes. It's the hand cutting of the glass which actually makes that slight waniness. It's very subtle. The edges are just ever so slightly uneven.
This one is called Venus Vitro, and in a way it looks like that Japanese game where you build up lots and lots of blocks. I mean, I'm not saying it is a game like that, but it has that quality to it, doesn't it? Where you have lots of pieces of glass balancing on each other, getting higher and higher up.
I understand what you're saying exactly. And in fact, when I was making this piece, I mean, as you see it, it's all bonded together completely solidly. But when I was making it, I had a free pile of pieces of glass which I had to one by one remove from the stack in much the same way as one would play Jenga. Mm-hmm. And so I had to wedge those surrounding layers so that I could withdraw them and hope the whole thing didn't collapse while I was doing it. It drove me nearly mad, actually.
Dr. Peter Newsome, thank you very much indeed for showing me your sculptures. It's been most interesting.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Going through a serious life trauma can make it difficult to stay in touch with the real you, especially if you've had a family breakup, problems with addiction, suffer poverty, or perhaps have had a breakdown. A new photographic portrait exhibition opens on August 24th at Cambridge Arts Salon, which attempts to capture the spirit of people as they recover and overcome from their problems and show the first glimmers of inner happiness. The show of 25 images are by Cambridge photographer and digital photography teacher Mark Woods-Nunn, who works with people involved with Flack magazine and other groups in the city. Teaching digital photography is increasingly interesting and a complicated thing to do now, isn't it?
It is. I mean, to be honest, I teach both traditional and digital. So I really like Photoshop, and I really like the things you can do with that. But I'm very much of a mind that when you put limitations on yourself, it actually stimulates creativity. So I really like teaching traditional. Unfortunately, it's more of a niche thing now. But there is an undercurrent. There are people that are still into it, and hopefully we'll be starting up a dark room shortly in Cambridge.
Now, what do you focus on yourself in your photography? Obviously, there's lots of different kinds of photography and genres to go through, but what do you prefer?
People. Yeah. I just love people and their stories, which is kind of the ethos behind the piece I'm going to talk about. But I'm very much kind of, people person, portraiture, and just kind of helping people to relax and just enjoying hearing their stories, really.
So this is, I mean, I saw, I'm just trying to remember what the name of the athlete was, from Jamaica, who won in the Olympics the other day.
Oh, Usain Bolt, yeah.
Bolt had that fantastic kind of Olympian pose at the end of it. Does that kind of thing appeal to you as a photographer? Because he obviously did it for the cameras, but it was a rather good shot, wasn't it?
It's interesting. He's obviously playing it. That's part of who he is. Yeah. That's his character. Yeah. I'd really like to meet him, actually, and I'd like to perhaps get to know him and kind of get beyond who he is, the facade, but the image he puts across, and find out what he's like. And I kind of like exploring the ideas and maybe shooting him in a different way to what he's currently presented as. Yeah, I mean, it's quite a challenge as well, particularly some of the work I do is with FLAC magazine in Cambridge, excellent organisation, who work for the homeless and so on. And when I go in there to do shoots, portraiture for the front covers and so on, I literally have about 15 minutes per person. So it's kind of like flicking on, trying to get to know who they are and where they are at. Yeah, it's interesting. It's good fun.
And do you work in black and white still?
I do, but when I shoot digitally, I shoot completely in raw. Yeah. So we get the digital information in colour, and then in post-production, I convert it to black and white. But it largely depends upon the image, what I'm trying to say, and from that I can determine whether I'm going to go black and white or colour.
What are the advantages of using digital cameras now? I mean, how far have they moved photography along in recent years? Because they just get better and better, don't they, the cameras?
They do. In terms of the advantages, obviously you can shoot ad nauseum and it's limitless. Yeah, I mean, there's a freedom in that, but also it constrains you. Because, in terms of post-production, you've taken loads and loads of photographs and spent ages trying to sort them. Some would argue perhaps film is more romantic. Yes and no, but I'd certainly the process of doing it, particularly if you're printing it yourself, definitely. So advantages in terms of digital, Photoshop and manipulation, film much slower, but it's more magical, I would say.
Okay, so when you take one of your students and you're teaching them about something, I mean, obviously, most photographers, you only get a really good snap once in a while that comes off really, really well. But how do you take them through their project, take their project from the start through to the end? How does that work as a teacher?
Sorry, largely, firstly, I'd kind of, we look at how a picture works, what makes a good image, and part of the process, without sounding too deep, is kind of finding out a bit about them and what they consider to be an image, what works. So often it will just literally be getting around a table, looking at their work, looking at the work of people that they like, and from that determining, okay, what works in this image, how can I emulate that? And then we kind of work on the practical side, the technique. But in terms of photography, I would always say the first thing, most important thing, is you as a photographer, i.e. you're deciding what you're going to capture. Then the image, what's in the frame, what's actually in it, what you're trying to say, a story about, or what you're capturing. And then thirdly, the actual camera itself. I think, we can get too caught, and particularly when you're talking about megapixels and so on, it's like, oh, got to have the latest camera. Lens before the camera anyway, always have quality lens. Than the body itself.
Yeah. Okay, now talking about your work in particular, you've got this exhibition coming up at Cambridge Arts Salon, which is weekend after next, is it?
Yeah, 24th.
The 24th. Yeah. Can we have a look at some of your photographs and talk about those? A lot of portraits. Can you tell me a little bit about what's in those? They each tell a person's story.
Indeed, yeah. So the photographs in themselves are quite simple. I didn't want it to be busy anyway. Tons and loads of stuff going on, but they're connected directly with a record, a disc, with the person's musical choices on, and beneath that will be their story as to why they've chosen their music, like Radio 4 Desert Island discs, but they've chosen a specific piece of music which perhaps relates to an event in their life.
All of your photographs that I've been having a look at, they have that way of sort of capturing the life and soul of a person when they're relaxed, and they're not trying to do anything pretentious. You're trying to catch them at those moments when they shine through, and they do all have that very relaxed and adult look to them. Is that what you really try to achieve with those portraits?
Yes, it is. Thank you. Appreciate that. Definitely. The way I see a shoot is that basically I just have a chat with someone and we kind of talk, and it just so happens at the end of that process we've got a photograph. Particularly with this project, it's been very good because, as I said, there's a mix of individuals from various backgrounds, and I was kind of a bit subversive, to be honest, because I mixed that up. So people were interacting with one another on a shoot, but they didn't know the background that someone was from. So it's kind of the idea of you bringing boundaries down.
Now, are you challenging the assumptions people make about people, basically, with your photography? Because these are people, a lot of them have had a terribly tough time, whether they've been terribly hard up, they've gone through traumas in their lives, they may have had problems, mental health problems or drug problems and what have you. Yet what you're doing is basically showing the other side of them, isn't it?
I'm kind of the mind people are people, whatever their belief system or whatever they're into, and it's not for me to judge that, and I just want to kind of show that kind of humanity. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, you're capturing the humanity.
Who they are.
Can you tell me a little bit about the involvement of FLAC in this project?
Well, basically they gave me some studio space for a couple of the shoots. It was an opportunity for the people involved in FLAC, the use of FLAC, if you want to put it that way, to pose. And I've kind of got established a relationship with them over the last couple of years.
A stunning set of photographs. It's kicking off at Cambridge Art Salon.
So Friday evening is the launch party, and then it will be so there's events happening on the launch party, and then it will run through to the following Tuesday.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of Arts Roundup. I hope you've enjoyed listening in on Cambridge 105 FM, and we'll send us your arts news in and around Cambridge.